Welcome to the Golf Legends Podcast, where we cover the champions and major winners of golf. Your hosts and main contributors are Dustin and Chad. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, guys, how are we doing today?
Pretty good, Chad. Welcome, awesome. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah, thanks for coming back and checking out the Golf Legends Podcast. Today we're going to be covering Francis Ouimet, an American-born golfer. He was born May 8th, 1893. So this one we're taking back a ways. This is American golf in its infancy, about as far back as it goes in the United States. He was an American golfer that really took away kind of the uppity, elitist British upper-class stigma that golf had up until he really came into the golfing world. So he did a lot for golf in the way of bringing it to the masses. So that's kind of his claim to fame. And another fun fact is Shia LaBeouf played him in the movie The Greatest Game Ever Played. If anybody ever saw that movie.
It is absolutely a great movie. It's up there with, you know, good old Vagar Vance, but this one was an actual, based on the true story of Francis, and he was an amazing golfer. He was an amateur. He was one of us, except he somehow won the U.S. Open and is the only amateur to ever do that.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
He started out as a this is the crazy part, is he lived across this country club, and the country club was going to hold the U.S. Open, and taught himself how to play golf with his older brother, and they buried a couple of tomato cans in their backyard and made a sand trap and made a swamp and did everything they could with one club to really learn the game of golf as they were just watching it. Because what Chad said was right, is this elite sport from England and from the British Isles, it was translating in the United States in the same way. You had all the upper class playing this sport, and the lowly people, the normal middle class to poor people, were tending it. You know, they were the greenskeeper, they're the caddies, and
yeah.
When Francis finally was old enough, he was a 20-year-old caddy. He had caddied for a couple of years at I believe Brookline, the Brookline Country Club, and he won. So we're going to kind of talk about how he won and then what he did to go on from that. But he won against, and if you've seen the movie, you'll know this, he won against Harry Vardon, which was a phenomenal golfer at the time. Had his own golf ball, you know, the Vardon golf ball.
We've all heard of the Vardon Trophy.
Yes.
You know, for the lowest average, I believe, over the course of an entire year. Is that correct?
Yes.
And we may have to check on that. But
yeah,
I think
it's when he, you get the lowest, basically your lowest scores are tallied up, your median scores, and if you're the lowest, you get the Vardon Trophy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's crazy talk. And the other guy, and I don't know why I don't have his name, but his name's Ray.
Ted
Ray, thank you. Yeah. He had just won. So you had Vardon, who was a 4-time British Open winner. That was their major championship at the time, besides this U.S. Open, which was truly in its infancy. Him, Vardon, and Ted Ray. Ted Ray had just won that year the British Open. They came over to play the U.S. Open. They felt like they were dominating, and they were. They were winning all the rounds, and then we
met. Francis came into play here.
We met, came back from nowhere, and the crazy part of all this is that if you think about it, he is an amateur 20-year-old playing against literally the world's best, a guy who has his own, hitting his own golf ball with his name on it.
Really, the only thing that we met had going for him was that it was his home course.
It was, yes.
He was a caddy there. He was 20 years old.
Yeah, he knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. He knew how to at least tell people how to play the course. He obviously played the course and hit balls, and in, if you watch the movie, there's a great little montage of Shia LaBeouf hitting balls, and I believe it's his caddy master kind of teaching him and showing him how the course works and everything.
Yeah.
But that's what this was like. So he actually entered We're going to start kind of at 1913. He entered a local tournament. He's in Massachusetts. He enters the Massachusetts State's Amateur Championship, and he wins it. And he's basically inspired at that point to enter the National Open, which is the U.S. Open. That's what it is.
Yes.
And so he sees, obviously, that this U.S. Open is in his home course, his caddying course. He's playing through the rounds. After three rounds, he's somehow tied with Varden and Ted Ray. And we're going into the fourth round, this final round. It's not the greatest weather. It's coming down to play, and ends up birdieing the 71st hole and tying them for that. Well, in that, in those days, and they somewhat do, but I think they've got rid of it where a full playoff is a full 18.
Yeah, they used to do that, and part of it was, you know, obviously today we've got lighting and we've got all sorts of things where it allows them to play more hours through the day, whereas back then, you know, you had to play with the sun, and if it was a cloudy day out, they just didn't do things the way they do now. They play. If you tied, you played a full playoff. It wasn't a sudden death.
Yeah, full 18 holes. Yeah, it didn't matter. I mean, you could obviously lose in the playoffs early if you succeeded 9 holes and you succeeded the 10th. You would lose all automatically. It wasn't you getting back.
Exactly.
But so
the front nine.
Yeah, the front nine. He's playing. I mean, I got that they're all, you know, we met, took the lead, and he's all going through Varden, Ray, and him. So it's the three of them. They get down to the 17th, all right? It's a par 4. Ray is pretty much out of it at this point. He's done. But Varden is one shot behind him on the 17th. Varden hits I would imagine, some form of a low stinger. He catches a bunker, and he's taken a bogey. And we met at that point, drilled a 15-foot birdie to win the championship. And if you see the movie, that's where he gets held up, and his father's there, and people are cheering him because he's not going to win any money because he's an amateur.
Yeah.
So they're giving him money, and who knows? I'm sure some of that happened. But
would have been amazing to be there.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Exactly. But to we'll come back to that as well, because that's an amazing story in itself, and there's some more threads going there. But the next year, he goes out and he wins. In 1914, he wins the U.S. Amateur. So he's the only golfer, the amateur golfer ever, to win the U.S. Open. And then he went backwards and won the U.S. Amateur.
Yes.
And it's usually you hear Tiger Woods, you hear Jack Nicklaus, you hear a bunch of these golfers, and they've won one, two, three U.S. Open amateurs, and then they win the U.S. Open, you know, they eventually win that. But it's always that way. It's always the amateur and then the Open.
So then after he wins the U.S. Amateur in 1914, he opens a sporting goods shop.
With his brother, I think, right? Yeah.
And the USGA bans him from amateur competition.
I love it.
Which they say was a disgusting miscarriage of justice that was later reversed. Because he never did actually turn pro his entire career, and he probably will be one of the only people that we cover in the podcast that was an amateur golfer their entire career.
Yeah, I mean, he's a famous golfer in every sense. I mean, you get a movie made about you, you're a great golfer, but you talk about truly loving the game of golf for being an amateur, and this guy is the one that embodied it for the United States. He's the Tiger Woods, he's the Arnold Palmer, he's the person that got you, the amateur golfer, got me at that time, got Chad, got all of us to want to play golf and bring it not into you had to have an elite status and a ton of money or anything like that in order to play it or join a country club. It was there were people lining up to play then. If this caddy could win, if this 20-year-old kid could win the U.S. Open, I could win it. I mean, you know, it was this great motivational thing.
Yeah.
And he never, from what I'm understanding through his life, he kept his amateur ranking because he wanted to be one of them. I mean, he didn't want to be pro. You know, he wasn't, whether he thought he was good or not or anything like that, he was, he always was an amateur. And yes, he played in the U.S. Open again, and he played in the, a more amazing fact is he won another U.S. Open when he was 38. A U.S. amateur. And it's like, that's insane, because you think of the U.S. amateurs when I was a chef at Chambers Bay, when I was there for that, the people coming in were college students. I mean, they were 18 to 22.
Yeah, they're kind of at the make it or break it. They're trying to make a name for themselves and trying to see if they can cut it to be able to go pro and be a professional golfer. And if they play some tournaments and they play the amateur circuit and they're not winning, then they go and take their degree and start working a normal job.
Yeah, or doing it, becoming a golf coach or become. Yeah. I mean, you know, like, and that's. He not only kept his amateur status, he went backwards again, competed in the U.S. amateur, and won it again at 38.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Yes.
That's absolutely crazy.
So after winning the U.S. amateur in 1914, so we're going back a little bit, this is the year after he won the U.S. Open. He opens a sporting goods store, gets banned from amateur competition. Yep. That ruling gets reversed, and then he returned to play in the inaugural Walker Cup team in 1922 and the seven that followed, serving as a captain in four more thereafter.
Which I didn't have in our notes, but I did glance over. Surprisingly, we didn't take anything from Wikipedia this time, so hooray, I guess, for that.
Yippee.
But he won those not him himself, his team, the ones he captained. I think he won. Did you say how many did you say he went to? Or did you just say?
He went to seven.
So seven. I'm almost positive he only didn't come back with it twice. Yeah. So I think he was.
This guy did a lot of winning.
Yeah, I mean, and he's an amateur again. I mean, like, this is the part that you got to really understand. We're going to be talking about legends and champions and these great figures of golf. This guy is up there because he showed greatness, but chose to stay with the normal ranks, I guess. Yeah. I mean, right? Like,
it's hard for us to fathom because I'm sure the culture was just obviously the dynamic was different, and
completely
different. You know, there weren't as many colleges, and college sports was not a thing really at that point in time. So
we went from 1914 to 1922 when he was in the inaugural Walker team, and then in 1931 is what I was saying is he won another U.S. amateur at the age of 38.
Yeah.
And at that point, was an international figure. He played Bobby Jones at some point. He was playing professionals on some levels, but he wasn't being a professional. He wasn't taking money. I mean, that was regardless of side bets or anything like that. There wasn't an exhibition game, you know.
He has another career. I mean, he's playing a lot of golf tournaments and stuff. But like Dustin saying, he's not making the big purses that the Bobby Jones.
No, the Walter Hagans, he's not doing that. I mean, he's not getting those things.
So that's why we have these gaps.
He's probably playing
local tournaments, but the documentation on that is far and few.
And that's what is awesome. I mean, you know, like, it's. He think about it this way too. We won the U.S. amateur twice, right? 1914, and then 17 years later. So he's still golfing. He gets kicked out of the amateur status on some levels, right? He gets this is revoked from him. So whether he is at that point playing exhibitions or anything like that, that's a little harder to tell. But he's not entering tournaments, right?
Yeah.
He's not in these things and winning a huge sum of money. And so the USGA figures that was wrong for what he did because he didn't win it during golf. He was trying to make money off of his likeness, basically, or in a sporting goods store, not even a golf store. I mean, this is the hilarity of it. And then 17 years after his first U.S. Amateur Championship, he wins it again. I mean, that's amazing. I mean, and it wasn't because, I mean, obviously he was playing, he was still playing international golf. He was playing in the Walker Cup. He was playing before that. But that's that amount of time. I mean, we talk about Tiger Woods not winning in, I don't know, 5 to 7 years or however long it's been. I mean, it might be 10 years at this point, but you've got to be kidding me. Like, it's 17 years is a lifetime, and especially in golf. And this is in the early 1900s. I mean, this isn't... Yeah. This isn't... Yes. We're not talking about modern medicine here. We're not talking, you know, like...
Yeah. It's a pretty amazing. So he wins, obviously, he won the one U.S. Open, and then he ends up going on and winning two amateur majors.
Yep.
So those are his three major championships that he won, which were the majors, three major championships of the day. And then we'll just kind of go into some more stuff, kind of some fun facts about him that he played against Bobby Jones 4 times, and won their first meeting in the 1920 U.S. Amateur, and then Jones went on to win the next three after that.
Bobby Jones is considered one of the greatest golfers of all time, and major winner.
Let alone
of all time.
At the time he was playing against Francis Ouimet. Yeah,
yeah.
So he was, he could hold his own against anybody, and that's why we're talking about
him. Exactly. He's an amateur that could go after. I mean, he could go after the pros, so to speak. He could be in a game with the best people of the day. I mean, Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, these people are the golfing royalty. I mean, they're before Nicholas. They were the ones that Nicholas was shooting towards.
Yeah.
So it's him being able to not only win a game against him, yes, Bobby Jones was an amateur, but win a game against him and then at least hold his own is amazing.
Oh,
he's amazing as an amateur.
And he's got a few a quote that's kind of funny that we found here, saying that a match against Bobby Jones is just as though you got your hand caught in a buzzsaw. He said he coasts along serenely, waiting for you to miss a shot, and the moment you do, he has you on the hook, and you're never going to get off. So that's how these games went with these guys. They were in such control of their golf game and playing at such a high level that. Really, they were just ahead of their time, and their equipment was so far behind them that they all pretty much hit the ball the same distances. They all basically had the same capabilities as far as being able to hit shots, just because the equipment was
behind. You had all different types of body shapes. You were using a persimmon. Yes, your ball might be a Varden. It might be something different. You didn't have a tee like we have a tee now. You had sand. I mean, if you go to Bandon Dunes, or I'm sure other golf courses around the area that are the high that like to represent the classic form of golf, you can buy this cute little, looks like a thimble, and you know, you put sand in it, and that was your tee. You put the ball on that, and it's
exactly
and that's the great part of Francis Ouimet, is that he did all of this and was a great golfer and was self-taught and was a normal person, you know, didn't come from any form of upper classness. I mean, his parents were immigrants. Another great fact, in 1951, Ouimet became the first American to serve as captain at the Royal and Ancient Golf Clubs of St. Andrews. That quote, that statement right there is mind-blowing. He's a U.S. American, or, I mean, I'm sorry, a U.S. amateur.
Yeah.
And he's being basically inducted into this, into the history of golf. Yeah. I mean, they're
not
the
even
ones.
A pro.
Yeah, this is the ones, they started golf. I mean, they're, and yes, on some levels they're uppity, on some levels they are pretentious. But they welcomed him in, like showing how good he could be, and frankly, how good a steward of the game he was. That is where his legacy, I think, goes to. I mean, the U.S. Senior Open Trophy is named in Ouimet's honor. It's Francis D. Ouimet Memorial Trophy. So if you win the Senior Open, or if you see that trophy, that's named after him. And this is, again, this is an amateur golfer.
And he like, served we can't as a stress, captain yeah. at the age of 58.
Yeah, we can't stress this enough, that this, like when they say anything can happen, if you do enough and you're good and you understand how to play golf, or I guess a sport that is like golf, you could be a champion. And it could be a normal person. I mean, it could be and it took. I mean, he just loved the game. I mean,
yeah, part of it was he chose to never be professional. Obviously, his accolades say that he could have played professionally and he would have had a great amount of success, but he chose to go down this route. Which, you know, we talked about Byron Nelson before, and Byron Nelson didn't play for very long. He made his money and he wanted to buy a ranch. And that's what he did. He had kind of a similar upbringing. He's very blue collar, like came up poor, didn't have money. And it was just a different time, you know, where you know, golf nowadays is so focused on money and the winnings and all that sort of thing. Where a lot of these guys, it seemed like, it was a side hobby.
Yeah. And it was fun. It was something they just entered. Yes, there were exhibitions. Yes, the top golfers. I mean, we talked about Byron Nelson, the cream of the crop, did play exhibitions, did get money, for appearances. It wasn't a ton of money like it is now, but absolutely. And this is a person that didn't do that. I mean, this is a person that chose to stay in the amateur ranks.
Yeah. And that's why, this kind of segues in nicely. There's the Francis Ouimet Scholarship Fund, and it's a scholarship fund that was started on his behalf because of his upbringing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's meant to get people into the game. There were very few players in America, no public courses, and the game was confined mostly to the wealthy when he started playing. And Ouimet's victories changed all of that. His victory and unlikely background combined to create an inspirational moment. That's a quote from the Francis Ouimet Scholarship Fund.
And take that for just a second. The only major way you found news out was newspapers.
Yeah.
All right. You didn't have. So this was traveling the country and part of the globe, most likely, and especially in England and in Scotland, in Ireland, like in the Isles. And this was giant. I mean, this was a moment in the sports history that will never be repeated.
I don't think they could communicate to Europe at this point in time.
I mean, you're getting close to the. Oh no, 1913. So that's a good question.
1911 was when the Titanic.
That's right.
Sank.
Yeah. So they're if anything, they're shipping that newspaper across on a boat.
It might take a few days before Europe even hears about some of this stuff.
Man.
So it's amazing. So
or telegrams or something like that. It's got to be. Yeah.
A fun fact from the World Golf Hall of Fame says that in 1913, when he won the U.S. Open, there were about 350,000 Americans playing golf. 10 years later, there were 2 million.
Like, that's crazy. That's insane. It's not understanding. Like, that is 10 years is nothing in a sport, right? And he did so much, and with his win, did so much to make the sport public, to make the sport not a private country club.
Yeah.
You had to join. You had to pay an expensive fee.
Yeah,
and
you
look,
had
country
to be
clubs.
A caddy to play.
Yeah, country clubs are great. I love country clubs. The greens are always manicured. People are usually pretty nice.
Sometimes, you never know.
I mean, And we've played some public courses that aren't the greatest, but it's still
golf. We've also played some public courses that are great.
Yeah, it's still golf. It's still, I mean, that's, there were no public courses. Yeah. I mean, there were country club courses, you know, like.
And this just, he was the gateway for normal Americans to get into the game. For your average average Joe to get into the game, and that's amazing.
So as we semi start wrapping up, was an immigrant of the United States. His father was French Canadian. His mother his father was named Arthur Ouimet, and his mother Mary Ellen Burke was of Irish descent. Ouimet's wife was Stella Sullivan. They married in 1918, and then she died in 1965, 2 years before Francis. They had two daughters. Obviously his life became a movie that Shia LaBeouf played in the greatest game ever played, and he never turned pro. You know, he did compete in a couple more U.S. Opens where he placed fifth the year after he won it and then third in 1925. So again, and I'm not going to... Ali is not the right comparison here, but it's the only one I know. When Muhammad Ali couldn't box, the whole draft thing happened, he couldn't do it. They barred him from boxing. It is what the USGA on some levels did to Francis Ouimet. Mm-hmm. He couldn't play in amateur tournaments anymore from, what was it, 1914 or 1915 when he had his thing, to basically 1922.
Yeah, I mean, he got shut out for a stretch of almost a decade.
I mean, that's, and then came back. After 1922, he's playing in Walker Cups. He is getting some international.
Well, that's how long it took for the USGA to overturn the decision.
Yeah.
He owns a sporting goods store. Like, yes, that's possibly a conflict of interest, but not really. Yeah. I mean, people do that. People own, you know, all sorts of athletes own all sorts of restaurants and stores and all sorts of things now.
And so. Everything you find about him is he just loves sport as well. You know, he loves hockey.
Yeah,
he
it's not
baseball.
A golf store.
No.
It's a sporting goods store.
I love it. Yes. You gotta love the USGA, man. Yeah. Even back then, they were sticklers.
Outrageous decisions going back 100 years.
But so he plays in his first Walker Cup in 1922. But then he got in third in the U.S. Open again in 1925.
Yeah.
Like, he's an amateur still.
And he's basically playing a pro-type circuit, but as an amateur. I mean, he's playing in all the top tournaments.
He never turned
pro. Maybe not the majors, but he's playing in all the top amateur tournaments and some other tournaments that he gets in just because of his skills and his ability. But still... As we've stated 100 times already, was an amateur the entire time.
In 1974, about 7 years after his death, he was elected to the World Golf Hall of Fame. The neat thing I was going to say, and I got sidetracked, was if you watch The Greatest Game Ever Played, you saw a kid as Shia LaBeouf's caddy. And this was a true part of that story. His name was Eddie Lowry, and he was a 10-year-old boy. So the legend grows. I mean, that's the only thing you can say, right?
Yeah.
So he was supposed to have a caddy. He didn't. It didn't happen, or maybe he wasn't, because he was just. I think in the movie, and I'm not sure because it doesn't go that great into detail, that he was. Yeah, I think he just assumed he was going to carry his bag, and then a caddy was required. So he got Eddie Lowry, and they won. He won with a 10-year-old. He won.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just great.
Yeah, like it just adds some icing to the story. It just makes it that much sweeter that this guy really was just like a working class golfer who didn't fit the mold at all.
No,
you know, the Happy Gilmore of sorts. You know, he pulls in the homeless guy to carry his clubs because he has to have a caddy. And that's kind of like the story here. This 10-year-old kid that probably is, you know, he's not even as tall as the bag, and he's probably dragging this bag along.
Oh, I love it.
You know, they only played with a few clubs back then, so I'm sure it's a lot lighter than
what the
clubs were today. But yeah, you know, Lowry's still part of the story. He played a major role in the book because there's a book titled The Match.
Which is what the movie's based on,
yeah,
right?
And that was written by a guy named Mark Frost. And that was written a long time ago. The movie was made. And Lowry grew up to be a successful businessman and owned a car dealership on the West Coast. And he's also a major patron of amateur golf. He still supported it, and he embraced the role that he played as a child. Never really played, you know, competitive golf, but was involved in the sport.
Yeah, and we met's friend until we met's dad. I mean, yeah. He was a pallbearer at we met's funeral, so he was intrinsically bonded with we met throughout their lives because of this event. I mean, because of how great and wonderful this event was. The funny fact is he liked to boast that his employees, because he'd employ amateur golfers, that his employees could, his, like, basically a twosome could beat any other twosome in the world. And so Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson took up the challenge one year.
And they only beat him by one.
Yeah. It's so good. We just talked to you how good Byron Nelson was. Yeah, that's awesome.
Two car salesmen play against Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson.
Oh.
And they only lose by one stroke. So
two of the greatest golfers of all time.
Lowry sounds like he was a pretty good trash talker.
Yeah.
But they did a lot of like fundraising events back then, which you don't see very often now. You know, Tiger and Phil
just did their
like $9 million.
Jesus,
you know,
I'm sorry, we got it. Yeah,
that's a whole other thing.
That was a rough one, man.
But this was a lot more common. You know, Byron Nelson.
He
couldn't be in the military for medical reasons, but he did everything he could to raise money, and that was a common thing back then, was to play to raise money, and it wasn't necessarily to make money, but it was to travel and to promote.
Exactly, yeah.
And
to make enough to live.
Which is something that I really miss. Like, I don't miss. I wish that we had more of in today's golf. Because it just sounds like a much more fun, laid back, you know, atmosphere where you're playing the game for fun, and, you know, there's not necessarily any big trophies on the line. It's more about just playing the game.
Exactly.
And getting celebrities involved.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I guess it's like a pro-am of some sort. Yeah. But yes, but it would be cool to see a twosome against a twosome. It would be, I mean, I think that's why the Ryder Cup, and it was the Walker, I believe the Walker Cup back then, I think that's why it drew so much appeal. And the Ryder Cup's doing it again, but it's bigger teams. But seeing those twosomes or onesomes playing against each other, it's just kind of fun, you know? Because, like, yes, you are playing the course, but ultimately you're playing against someone else, too. You got to know what the person to the right or the left of you is doing.
Exactly.
In closing, because Francis we met life was a great life. I mean, he loved golf, and Chad talked about it earlier. He started the Francis we met scholarship fund. It is the golf charity of Massachusetts. It's one of the largest independent scholarship organizations in New England. It was founded in 1949 by friends of we met was still alive at that point, so we obviously saw it, and it awards college scholarship funds to young people who have worked as in caddies or in a pro shop or a course superintendent, basically the workers of a golf course. And it's and if you were to take anything from this us babbling for around 30 minutes, he was an amateur that never forgot his roots.
Yeah.
He never wanted or did turn pro. He just didn't want to.
Yeah.
He wanted to be the everyman. He wanted to show that anyone can play this game, and frankly, anyone could win. And it was that love of the game that made him a great steward.
That made golf what it is today for us, all of us.
And I'm telling you, go watch the movie. I mean, it's a free plug to the movie. The movie's great. The movie, you watch the movie, and you will want to go play golf.
Yes.
You will wonder how this happened, because it's truly remarkable that this amateur beat two of the very best professionals. And it's great. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, just to recap, we were talking about Francis we met May 8th, 1893. And he died September 2nd, 1967, in Newton, Massachusetts.
Yeah, one hell of a life, man. So one hell of a life.
He came full circle, and he never forgot his roots.
No.
He died in Massachusetts, which is where he was born. He was an amazing, amazing golfer who really made the sport available to people like you and I. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for listening. We got the fun little outro. We appreciate you jumping on this fun little journey with us, and I'll keep trying to come up with cute little tags that you can check out the show with, and we'll hit this social media at some point. We just don't enjoy it that much.
and we did, you know, I know I did. I think Dustin did too. We went out on a stretch a few times and guessed. So if there's a there's anything we need corrections
absolutely,
on,
yeah, we love corrections.
If you enjoyed our show, please rate us on Apple iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Golf Legend Pod. If you have ideas on who we should cover or just want to drop us a line, please do at golflegendspod@gmail.com.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back on the links in a week.